what can you do as a parent as your kids are at home and you're working with them on math? You've probably noticed that what your kids are learning in math is a little bit different than what you've learned, and it probably looks a little bit goofy. And so how is it that you can help your child learn actual real math?
The Family Freedom Podcast, voices of family and freedom. Now here's your host, Wendy Hart.
So today I am joined by James Wilson, and he is a retired educator. He's taught every elementary grade, kindergarten through sixth, and taught in middle and high school. And he is currently blogging, he says irregularly, at The Underground Parent, and he is a co-founder of Truth in American Education, and just has vast amounts of experience with math and math instruction. And so, welcome, James.
Thank you, Wendy. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Tell parents, you know, say I'm an average parent at home, and my kids are struggling with math, and now I'm here in a more, you know, prime position to see what's going on and what the concerns are. How do I get my kid to learn actual math as opposed to these different tips and tricks that we're currently seeing in math these days?
I think one of the things that it's a good idea for parents to do is to find out what their kids should be learning at the grade level that they're at and the skills that they should have. And I recommend that people download a document called Core Knowledge, Sequence, Content, and Skill Guidelines for K-8. And to find that, I would say just search for Core Knowledge Content. Again, search for Core Knowledge Content and then download the PDF document. It's loaded with a lot of information for actually all subject areas, kindergarten through eighth grade. It's organized by grade level and within a grade level by subject area. And for math, I find it to be very good. It's very, you know, concise information about what a kid should learn at each grade level in math. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good tool for parents to kind of see, where's my kid at in math? Mm-hmm. And what should I be working on with them? And I think that's really the really good thing about this is it is a guideline that can help parents know what they can be working with their kids on. Another thing I'd suggest is that they look for an old copy of a Saxon math book or Singapore math book to work with their kids on that. And Saxon has some good placement tests that are available online so that parents can use that. So those are some, you know, just some kind of starters,
right,
that I would suggest for parents.
Well, let me jump in here, because my understanding is that Saxon, you mentioned older Saxon math, because of course, when we got the Common Core math standards in, everybody jumped on that bandwagon and they've updated their curriculum to match. Saxon was one of those. So do you happen to know, is there like a particular edition, or are we looking at publication years? How do I tell the good Saxon, as it were, from the Common Core aligned Saxon? And can you still use the Common Core aligned Saxon?
I think with Saxon for kindergarten through sixth grade and probably maybe through eighth grade, I think that even the ones available now are probably still pretty good.
Okay.
And I don't know if they changed or how much they changed, but I think just as a rule of thumb, for Saxon and Singapore, both, if you look for something prior to the Common Core, which would be 2000, look for something that was published prior to 2010. For other math books, older math books, I would look for something, you know, maybe published in the 1970s, mm-hmm, or possibly the 80s.
Okay. What about the 1950s? If you have one of those laying around, that's probably pretty good.
I think that would be very, very suitable as well. If you've got some of those laying around. And, you know, if you don't have something like that lying around, but you would like to get your hands on it, there are places online like Abe Books, and I can't remember the name of another place, that you can order old textbooks.
Oh, awesome.
Like that.
Oh, I may have to start investing. Someday I might have grandkids and I might want them to learn math. So tell me a little bit more. One of the things that I know we talk about as math geeks is the standard algorithm, and that's one of the things with Common Core that has kind of been pushed back. Most people, I don't think, understand what a standard algorithm is and how to identify that. And so what's a standard algorithm and how do you know you're teaching kids that?
It's kind of hard to describe, I guess, what standard algorithm is. It's what most of us learned, you know, how we learned how to do addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division.
So like carrying the one, borrowing, yes, that sort of thing.
Yes, something that in a good math textbook, it would show examples of that, and it would actually teach it that way. With the Common Core State Standards, there's a delay of about 2 years for the standard algorithms. They delay the standard algorithm for addition and subtraction until fourth grade.
Oh, my goodness.
multiplication until fifth grade and division until sixth grade. And each one of those can actually be taught to, and should be taught, I feel, 2 years earlier than it appears in the Common Core State Standards. And the Common Core State Standards, instead of calling for the standard algorithm 2 years earlier, like I would like to see it, it calls for the using strategies based on place value, which does not prevent you from teaching the standard algorithm.
So you could do both.
By the way, because the standard algorithm is based on place value.
Mm-hmm.
Kids can learn it. You know, they can learn addition and subtraction and using the standard algorithm at second grade.
Mm-hmm.
And they can do multiplication with the standard algorithm in third grade. And in fourth grade, they can use the division standard algorithm if they're taught to do that.
Right.
And one of the pitfalls of using the strategies, as is often taught in our schools now, is they're taught these various strategies first, and then they have a couple of years to practice using those before they're faced with the standard algorithm. Well, what do we tend to do? We tend to use what we learn to do first.
Right. We like what we're familiar with.
Yeah. And the standard algorithm is actually much more efficient than these various strategies. And that's not to say that there isn't a use for these strategies. As a classroom teacher, I use these strategies to help kids understand how the standard algorithm works.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't teach them those strategies and expect them to use those strategies instead of using the standard algorithm.
Right. Give them what you want them to learn first, and then maybe then you're fleshing it out with everything else beyond that,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, that's... Yeah, that was something that I saw. I was lucky enough, my kids didn't have to deal with it until they were in middle school. But I did see that, you know, from other kids coming up in the neighborhood and, you know, helping out, that when you present these other practices beforehand, then it gets confusing to a lot of kids. And if they know how to do it one way, they're wondering, why do I have to do it these, you know, five other ways? And the standard algorithm works every single time, whereas sometimes some of the strategies I've seen, they only work under certain circumstances. And that's a,
yes,
problem, too. you know, just to give definition, the reason why a standard algorithm, it's a standard way of doing something, and it works that way. Every single time you have addition problems, you can add it this way and it will work. Or every time you're multiplying, you know, three-digit numbers, you do it this way and it will work every single time. So yeah, I see that being a problem. I've had friends with kids who have complained that they've gone to their teachers and said, my kid just wants to be able to do the standard algorithm. And the teachers will come back and say, that would be fine, except they won't do well on the end of year state testing. Do you have an opinion on that? I know, is there a direct correlation between teaching 15 different methods on how to multiply and state testing from what you've experienced or seen?
Unfortunately, the Common Core State Standards does call for, you know, teaching strategies based on place value at certain grade levels instead of teaching the standard algorithm.
Mm-hmm. So they don't just say multiply. They say multiply by doing X, Y, and Z.
And as a result of that, the tests end up having test items that are, you know, focused on, you know, say at second grade, they don't have a test item. They wouldn't have a test item that calls for using the standard algorithm. It's going to be some other strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But if a kid knows the standard algorithm and can use it, they can figure out those other strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And they should do just as well. As a matter of fact, I think they would probably do better than kids who only know the strategies but don't know the standard algorithm.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I actually, when my kids were little, I did download the core knowledge information. And I think it's important for people to understand that core knowledge has absolutely no affiliation with Common Core. You've got core in both of them, but there's no correlation at all between them. And what I liked about them, as you were talking about, is that they say, okay, so you're going to teach addition at this grade level, and then you're going to teach, you know, carrying the one, and you know, they give you all that specificity of what you need to do, and it builds every year. It builds on things, so you're not missing pieces. And what I've seen, especially in the higher level math with Common Core math, it's pretty random how it's taught. It's not taught in any logically coherent way, and we're just kind of picking and choosing concepts. So to relate it to like an elementary level, it'd be like teaching multiplication, but then we're going to teach subtraction, and then we're going to teach fractions, and then we're going to teach, you know, it just seems like it's all over the board and nothing really builds on each other. How do you as a teacher address some of these issues where, you know, you have the standards that you have to teach because pretty much everybody does? How do you fill in those gaps, and do you have advice for other teachers on how to give kids a good quality education in math and still, you know, do what the school is expecting you to do in state law?
Yeah. you know, getting in, we've kind of shifted from what parents can do to mm-hmm. you know, to things teachers can do. And teachers, I think, these days have to be careful with what they do, because many places, the Common Core State Standards are the standards that have been adopted by the state, whether they've been rebranded or not.
Mm-hmm. They're still obligated. Yeah,
the teachers have to adhere to that. You know, the teachers have to be careful for the sake of, you know, continued employment on their part, that they don't step over the line
mm-hmm.
of what their school district and state expects of them. But there are some things that they can do. I mean, a teacher can close the door if necessary and teach math in a way different than the pedagogy that's embedded in the Common Core, but they want to be careful that they don't run afoul of of what I call the curriculum police. And that may be a curriculum coach or the principal or somebody from the district office that's kind of overseeing and trying to make sure people are adhering to the prescribed standards and I have to say pedagogy, because with Common Core, there is pedagogy embedded in it. There are some other things that, teachers can do, and that is they can provide explicit example-based instruction. And in doing that, I always like to use what I referred to as I, we, you, and that's I would work some problems. I would, you know, a specific kind of problem. I would work a couple of examples with my class in front of the class, and then I would give them a problem to work, and we would work through it together. Then gradually to where then they would work one of the problems, and then after they've worked it, then I would work through it so that they could check themselves and see how they're doing. And if they're getting it, then it's time for some independent work, and that's the you part. I have to thank a principal that I had early in my teaching career that told me about that strategy, I, we, you. And I used it, and I've used that throughout the rest of my career. You're providing explicit example-based instruction when you do that. That's one thing that teachers can do, that rather than being the guide on the side where you give the kids a problem to work, but they haven't been given instruction on how to work the problem, but they're saying, they're being told, figure out how to work this on your own. To me, that's not instruction.
No, I would agree.
but unfortunately, that happens a lot, I think, in classroom these days, because it's kind of a constructivist approach. And that's an approach that a lot of teachers have, you know, professional development has been provided to a lot of teachers these days to use that kind of approach.
Are there benefits to that inquiry-based, you know, just give them a problem and let them work through it? Because it seems counterintuitive to me that's the reason you're in school, is because you don't know how to do this problem. And I, as the teacher, would be the one to show you. I mean, I understand that there's like a lot of psychology behind the idea of, well, if you discover it for yourself, you own it. But if you don't know where to begin, I struggle with that concept. And you've been involved in this a long time. Can you kind of speak to the difference between that inquiry base? Because those of us that are our age think, you know, well, of course, the teacher stands up there at the blackboard and writes down and shows you how to do it. But, you know, everything that I saw while I was on a school board was the guide on the side. You don't want to be the sage on the stage. Well, but then why go to school?
I think that kind of approach is just, it's another trick in the bag that can be used, and it can be used well, but it oftentimes isn't. While it may not be purely letting a kid construct their own learning, is provide the explicit instruction on the skills that they're going to need, and then provide them with an activity or a project where they have to apply those skills. And they may actually have to figure out which skills to apply when, but they've already been taught the skills that they need.
And it's just kind of synthesizing it back.
Yeah, they aren't having to try to discover those skills on their own. I see a lot of times, you know, project-based learning.
Right.
And I think, well, there is a place for that, but if you set out a project for kids to work on without their having the background knowledge to be successful at it, and you expect them to, you know, to kind of build that plane while it's flying in the air, it's not going to work as well as, you know, providing the background knowledge and skills and then giving an activity or a project where that knowledge and those skills are need to be used in that to show some actual more practical application.
Are there any things that you can recommend to teachers who say, I want to help my kids learn regardless of what the state standards are, they still should be able to learn math when they come out of my classroom?
I'm going to enjoy addressing this one. I'm going to address it kind of in two parts. One is I recommend that elementary teachers brush up on their math skills. And it's true, a lot of elementary teachers aren't real strong in math. Elementary teachers tend to be excellent teachers. If they're given something to teach, they can find a way to teach it, but they need to know what to teach and how to teach it. Usually they're good at the how to teach. So to brush up on their math skills, I recommend taking a refresher course, like an intermediate algebra course at a community college, to brush up on their skills and to see what skills students need to have to be able to use beyond elementary school.
Kind of where are we going with this? Huh?
Yeah, and it's a good way, because there are lots of things in math that teachers can spend time on. But, the question is it worth spending time on this? Like the Fibonacci sequence, is it worth spending time on that in a fourth grade classroom?
Probably not.
what purpose does it serve? It's interesting and might be fun to take a look at briefly with the kids and let them explore that on their own. When it comes to first and second year algebra and geometry, I haven't seen the Fibonacci sequence come into play anywhere there.
So but if they can't multiply, then that might be a bigger problem.
Right. And I would rather they be able to multiply and, have a handle on their basic facts. The second thing, brushing up on math skills is one thing. And I said that there are two parts to this. The other thing is, I think it's important for teachers to be familiar with what skills students should be learning prior in grades prior to what that teacher's teaching and in the grades that follow.
Mm.
And to talk with the teachers in those other grades about expectations. I know that when I really recall teaching sixth grade, that I had expectations of what sixth graders should walk into the classroom already knowing and skills that they should already be able to do in math that they didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd end up having to spend a lot of time doing things that they should have been proficient at the end of fourth grade. Teachers should be talking about that if those kind of conversations aren't formally provided for them. That doesn't mean a teacher can't go to another teacher and talk with them. And then a third grade teacher ought to be going to the fourth grade teacher and saying, what is it you expect when my kids come to you next year? What is it you expect them to be able to do in math? Because
mm-hmm.
I want to make sure I have them prepared for you. And so those are some things that the teachers can do. Teachers, I'm hoping, will see to it that their students have their basic math facts down mm-hmm. and are fluent.
That would be another thing that the parents can make sure. I mean, I know I had to bring home the big 100 problem sheets that, you had to do in 5 minutes when I was a kid. And I really struggled with those. And my third grade teacher, he'd send me home with five of them, and my mom every night, here we are, set the kitchen timer. So would you recommend something like that? Was my mom onto something?
I definitely recommend it. And that's something that I used in the classroom at all elementary grade levels, was I would use time drills, not too long,
mm-hmm.
of short duration, but intense. For the whole process with a class, it might take 5 to 10 minutes from mm-hmm. It's going to be short and sweet and do it at home or a teacher can do it in the classroom, and it doesn't take up, you know, a whole bunch of time. Say for multiplication, there are two kinds of drills that neither one of them really take a whole lot of time, but I recommend skip counting, writing lines of numbers just for the twos, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24. So those are the multiplication facts for the twos for 2 times 12.
Mm-hmm.
And writing those out in one line and timing it for 1 minute to see how many lines of that you can write. Now, we're not talking about a penmanship activity.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a speed activity. So, you know, you kind of look the other way if it's sloppy.
Right.
and then you keep a record. You do it every day. You time that for 1 minute, and you keep a record so that you can, that the kid can see progress. Kids can keep their own record of it as long as you set up some system for them to keep it. And then when they seem to be proficient at the twos, they move on to the threes, and they move on through the other levels. And, you know, throw some fun in there. Have a reward for reaching a goal, or you know, have them set a goal, and then provide them with a reward when they reach the goal. And skip counting is one of those kinds of things that writing it out works, but it's also something that can be done orally. It's a good car activity. You know, you're driving in the car, you've got the kid in the back seat, you know, hey, what, count by twos for me, or count by threes, whatever level they're working on. When they're proficient with that, then they move to the next one. You know, again, do some record keep. Have them, you know, keep a record of their progress on a daily basis so that they can see that they're doing. When they seem to be proficient, they move to the next level. You know, you also have something to celebrate and provide some rewards for.
Oh, I want to go back to what you were saying about keeping it fun, because I know that kids, especially little kids, their brains, you know, I mean, I can't tell you how many times my kids, you know, knew all the Disney songs and, you know, watched the same movies over and over and over again. Kids actually like repetition at those younger elementary grades. Do you have any recommendations for parents and teachers, I guess, if a kid is really struggling with that and it, you know, it's the tears and
Kids tend to do better when they meet with success is one of the things I've found. So providing them with things that they can and will be successful with, and then celebrating those successes. You know, I talked about skip counting and working on multiplication facts. Well, work on the skip counting for the level of multiplication facts mm-hmm. that they're, you know, working on, because there's a direct tie-in
mm-hmm.
To that. And if they can see that connection and realize, hey, it's skip counting. Mm-hmm. If I need to know what 2 times 3 is, I count by twos 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got it. And so if they can begin to see and make those connections, then it can make it easier for them. And the thing is, if they're struggling with it, you want to look at what factors may be contributing to that.
Mm-hmm.
Are the problems too hard? Is not enough time being provided?
Well, I liked what you said, the focus on, you know, that there's progress, but that it's attainable progress. It's kind of like losing weight, right? You can't set a goal that is too far out there that you'll never attain it, or it's just frustrating. And so finding those little interim steps for them is very, very helpful. Any other last minute recommendations for parents as they're going through and experiencing this?
Well, I've already said make it fun and acknowledge and celebrate success. Don't overdo it. If the math work is being overdone, if too much time is being spent on it, then it's no longer going to be fun for the kid. Have a set period of time so that the kids know that, hey, we're going to work on this, and we're going to work on it, you know, intensely for this duration, and then we're done for the day with this. Parents should become familiar with the expectation that their child's teacher has and the approach that they use in providing instruction. Now, that doesn't mean that the parent needs to use that same approach, but it's good to be familiar with it. And I tell parents to take responsibility for their own child's math education and not to leave it up to the school these days. Use math in everyday activities and relate it to the instruction that's taking place.
So if you're doing fractions, it's time to bake cookies.
Yes, you're baking cookies. Take that opportunity to, you know, to talk about fractions and see how that comes into play.
Well, thank you so much, James. I really appreciate it. It's been fun and educational, and I wish I'd known this 20 years ago.
Well, some of it took me a while to get it figured out, even though I was standing on my feet in the classroom working with the kids. But I did find things that worked for me. And I think another thing for teachers and parents alike is find what works for you. You know, the approach that works for me may not work for you because you're a different person, and you may have a little bit different style or a little bit different approach that's successful for you.
Yeah, take people where they're at, and what works for you and what works for that kid that's in front of you is going to be different. And that's why the one size fits all doesn't work. So, well, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
This has been the Family Freedom Podcast with Wendy Hart. Follow this podcast, share with your friends and neighbors, and add to the Voices of Family and Freedom.